Part 040. As September started, the harvest reached its peak volume, though not in amount of work, since things like berries were more fussy and time-consuming than potatoes or marrows. As the equinox approached, we had less daylight but about the same amount of produce to pick and prepare for delivery to the shopkeepers. But we were keeping up with it. The children started a new year at school, so they weren't around during the day, and could not be expected to do much when they got home. However, Delia still collected the eggs every morning and put out feed for the chickens. And Oliver now had twice as many rabbits munching away at weeds and cauliflower leaves and whatever else we could find that they would take. The ducks, since we got them late, only produced a few ducklings, but they were now getting bigger. We might have duck for meat sometime. When the time came for the rabbits to become meat and fur, it was Mabel who did the slaughtering and skinning of those for our own consumption. Those destined for the butcher we transferred to some of the cages that were loose and sat on shelves. The butcher would bring the cages back the next day, and we could use them as regular hutches when we didn't have rabbits ready for the pot. I was glad Mabel did the butchering. She also took care of the hens that had outlived their laying lives. We didn't raise any chicken for roasting. I suppose we could have, but we acquired our chickens as young hens and didn't raise meat chickens. The old hens went for soup and stew. Mabel asked me one day, "Do you know how to kill chickens?" I answered that I didn't, and that it rather scared me. "Nothing to it. I didn't want to really hear about it, so I interrupted and said, "Climb up the ladder and fix the slate in place." Mabel laughed. "All right. I understand. Each of us has our private fears." Thus I'd be the person who went up ladders, and Mabel would dispatch the livestock. Part 041. Jack telephoned me when he got back from firearms training and we went for a walk to a pub on a Saturday night. He'd suggested the pictures, but I said we wouldn't be able to talk. "True," Jack said, chuckling. After Jack had collected me from the farm and we were walking towards town, I asked him how was the firearms course. "Not bad. Actually rather interesting. I won't say exactly where it was, but I saw lots of bombed out houses. I can see why you left London. You hadn't understood how bad it was." "I don't see how anyone can understand how it is unless they see it. And you saw it happening. I can try to imagine that. But imagining isn't the same as experiencing. Remember how you showed up with a plaster all over your face and a big graze on your left hand?" "I suppose so. If you've lived through the Blitz, you think it's all over the country. Here in Taunton, I've almost forgotten the sirens. It was true. I no longer expected the sirens' wail." We walked for a minute or two without talking, my arm in his. It felt nice. I didn't remember William and I doing that, and wondered whether I'd forgotten, or if we'd never really walked together. Not that William and I went out together, even rarely. I asked, "Did you have to take any tests on the course?" "Well, the basic firearm qualification is with a Webley revolver. They hand you one loaded with 6 bullets and tell you to shoot at a target. If you get 3 of the bullets in the target out of the 6, they tell you you're qualified to handle firearms. The silly thing is that they don't show you how to load it. And if you are issued a Webley, you probably have to hang it on a lanyard, as apparently there's a big shortage of holsters." "That sounds a bit, I don't know, amateur. Perhaps I should be offended, but I actually agree with you. If we are sent out to tackle enemy servicemen, they'll probably have better weapons and also better training in their use. Some of us also got to try the rifle, but police and other auxiliaries have been issued with World War I Ross rifles from Canada. So they're rather old," I commented.
"The age isn't the problem. Lee Enfields from the same period would be preferred. The Ross was really a sporting rifle. Great accuracy, and preferred by snipers who'd pot enemy soldiers at over 600 yards. Nominally, the Ross and Lee Enfield used the same .303 ammunition, but the Canadians made it to tighter tolerances, and any dirt at all and the Ross'll jam. And where the Lee Enfield uses a bolt that you lift and pull to open, the Ross has a fancy mechanism so you just pull it back. However, you could disassemble it without tools, on paper an advantage, but if you didn't get it back together properly the gun could fire and the bolt would take half your face off. Canadian soldiers frequently picked up Lee Enfields from killed or wounded British soldiers, and eventually they were issued them and the Ross reserved for snipers. You didn't have any trouble with it?
No.
We had clean conditions, and I think we had Canadian ammunition. Probably left over from 1918. That, of course, could be a problem if the powder isn't stable or the shells stored improperly. What was your score on the shooting?
I got 5 out of 6 on the revolver. We only got to shoot 3 shots with the rifle, and that was from 100 yards, and I've got to admit, the Ross let me put all 3 in the bullseye.
Good for you.
Did you learn if you'll get any special chances?
I'm not sure.
There was this trio of men who called themselves the Civilian Police in Wartime Policy Review. They asked to talk to me and a few of the others. They said they wanted to know what conditions policemen and policewomen faced and how the system could be improved for greater effectiveness and efficiency. But it felt a lot like a job interview.
You think it might lead somewhere?
I think it already has. The Assistant Chief Constable has asked to see me next week. Much of the rest of the evening was spent enjoying a bit of a sing-song in a local pub. There were some men from the Royal Army Service Corps who had, according to Jack, recently set up at Norton Camp. They were in good voice, though not necessarily in tune. Indeed, the volume of song increased and quality decreased with the soldiers' consumption of beer. During a lull, Jack said interestingly, the Norton Camp, strictly Norton Manor Camp, is near the site of another of those Neolithic hill forts. Soon after Jack mentioned that, the noise and smoke encouraged us to take our leave, and we walked back to the farm, where Jack had left his bike. We didn't say a lot as we walked, but we seemed happy enough to saunter along hand in hand. As Jack was adjusting his bicycle lamp to ensure the slit did not show upwards, I said good luck with the interview. Jack didn't say anything, just gave me a little kiss and was off. Part 042. November 11, 1941. I'd another month until my new 24th birthday, but still had a sense that I had to at least privately acknowledge today. At the end of October, there'd been bad news from Huddersfield. Someone, must have been a man, left a lit pipe in his raincoat in Booth's clothing factory, an old 5-story building with no fire escape. News was coming out that they didn't have a proper working alarm, and had never practiced evacuating. 49 deaths, mostly young women. As if we didn't have enough to contend with. Fires like this would help the Nazis. Jack had been to his interview. He couldn't say exactly what he'd be doing, except that he'd been asked to help set up a small team of younger policemen who would be available on call to deal with special incidents. The special incidents were left without description. Unfortunately, this new job meant a transfer to Bath, with a promotion to sergeant. I'd got a letter yesterday with his new address, though he also gave me the address and telephone number of the police station from which he'd work. I couldn't think why I'd telephone, however. I wasn't next of kin. Probably just the way we had become closer. Pity there was still William casting a dark shadow. There was still some work to do outside. A few cabbages to cut and some of the potatoes that were late plantings to be lifted. Mabel had staggered the potatoes and Oliver had rather bullied her into estimating the planting dates so he could record them with the labels of the plots. We'd developed a letter number scheme since the layout of the farm could be considered approximately a rectangle. This meant we had harvested new potatoes for a while, then got the mature ones as the last new potatoes were still being sent to the shops. And we'd done well in yield according to the numbers Delia had found.
At breakfast, Mabel said we should get a load of manure from Mr. Jessup later this week. It'd be nice to get more, but the farmers all need fertilizer. I asked, is there anything else we can get that will help the soil? Possibly some leaves from the woods, but I think they may have the wrong acidity, but they could help to provide some fiber and structure. Thinking back, I realize that a year later, in November 1942, the government announced the availability of National Growmore fertilizer that was available even to home gardeners. A 42-pound bag was supposed to be enough for 300 square yards. We definitely got some, but not enough for all the plots, though it did help. In 1941, we took some sacks to nearby woods and filled them with leaves, preferably wet and partly decomposed ones. Heavier, but we felt more useful. Jessup brought us some manure, and the WI ladies who weren't gardening kept some of their compostable waste for us. I got used to watching for bits and pieces that might help. There was a small Armistice Day ceremony in town, but we didn't go. All of us were puttering around doing small jobs today. Some planting of winter crops had been done, and I was starting to look at the buildings. Over the year, I'd got more capable with tools. I'd never be a carpenter or builder, but I could make repairs that would hold, even if they didn't look particularly fancy. One job I started today was some hangers for our ladders. I'd found some short lengths of 2x2-inch wood, as well as some 1x2 lengths. Talking with Jack, I'd learned that if I did a butt joint to create an L, it would not be very strong, and he suggested what he called a half-lap joint. In the local library, I found a fairly recent book called Teach Yourself Carpentry and had been reading it. A lot of the joints were far too complicated, but I found ones called halved joints, and I later found those were what Jack was talking about. Figure 12 of the book showed a quite simple-looking joint, and I seemed to have the tools needed to make them. I'd need to saw halfway through each end across the grain, then along the grain to that cut I just made to get a 1-inch by 2-inch notch out of each part that would become the L. Then I could put them together with glue and one or more screws. George had mentioned one time that before screws went in, it was really necessary to drill holes so they went in more easily and didn't split the wood. I figured today was a good day to really clean up the small workbench in the byre, so I opened the window and got to work with a stiff scrubbing brush, but I used it dry. The debris on the bench was now mostly dust and old shavings. The tools we had were still mainly in the house under the stairs. They were in a couple of wooden boxes. It took 2 trips to bring them out, then I realized that it would be sensible to hang them on the wall behind the bench either side of the window. After I'd cleaned out the byre, I'd asked Mabel whether we should lock it to reduce the chance of theft. After all, there'd been sufficient demand for the farm products that Joe Short had robbed her. So now we had a good padlock on the byre. It wouldn't stop determined thieves, but it would prevent crimes of opportunity provided we were disciplined in locking up. Now we all had a key on a ribbon round our neck. Before I tackled the half-lap joint, I nailed up several flat boards either side of the window and put in some longish nails of a type George called finishing nails. They had a small head, and would go through modest holes in tool handles. Thus I was able to hang up the tools and more easily access them. It took several tries to get them arranged efficiently. In the toolbox were several clamps. I suddenly realized that they would let me saw the wood much more easily and used one to hold one of the 2x2s onto the bench. There was a folding ruler and a square. Also a couple of funny pencils with thick leads. I used my knife and sharpened one, marked off the piece that was to be cut out, and made the cut that was across the grain using a saw that had a metal ridge at the back of the blade. I think someone said it was called a back saw. I hoped it was sharp. It seemed to work. The Teach Yourself book had a page titled Remember, with one line, don't sharpen your own saws. It is cheaper to pay a professional sharpener, but where I'd find someone who did that I had no idea, though George would likely know. I wondered how to make the long ways cut. The bench legs were quite solid. 4 inches square, and they were flush with the edge of the bench, so I clamped my piece vertically. Better use 2 clamps so it didn't pivot on me when I tried sawing. My attempts at starting the cut were pretty dismal to begin with. And I made a bit of a hash where the edge of the joint would be, but eventually I got the hang of it. My result wasn't perfectly flat. Wouldn't be a great joint. I made the other part of the L, but this time only did the cross cut. Then I took a 1-inch chisel. I was about to hit the chisel with the hammer, when I remembered there was a wooden mallet. That was probably the proper tool to use. It was still in one of the toolboxes. I didn't try to cut off the whole of the piece of wood that would be waste, but positioned the chisel about halfway down. The wood was still clamped to the bench. Just in case, I gave the clamp screws another twist. Then I positioned the chisel, I guessed bevel side up, and gave the handle a sharp rap with the mallet. A piece of wood popped right off. However, it wasn't quite straight. The grain of the wood angled down a bit. So I positioned the chisel just a little above my cut line and got most of the rest of the waste away. What to do about the rest? There was a rasp. Rather rusty despite my efforts with the oil, since the teeth had kept grabbing my cloth. There was a rather funny brush with short metal bristles in the toolbox. Yes. It was for cleaning files and rasps. Well, I'd do that later. For now I applied the rasp carefully and got my notch cleaned up. Also cleaned up the notch on the other bit. The two pieces fitted together quite well. Be nice if the surfaces that touched were really flat. I'd need more practice. I fastened the two pieces of wood to the bench so the L was formed and found the small hand drill. It had a crank on the side that turned a shaft with a chuck. I found a drill bit that was a bit smaller than the screws I intended to use, then marked two points on the top piece of wood. How would I know how deep to drill? The Teach Yourself book showed a sort of device to clamp on the drill bit, but it would be too big. They also showed using some paper. Looking about, I realized we had some bits of chalk. Someone had fastened some slates to one of the posts of the byre, and we used the chalk to record weights when we had multiple sets of sacks to weigh and add up. I positioned the drill beside my wood with the tip as deep as I thought about right, then put some chalk on the drill bit. It didn't stay on very well, but was enough for me to judge. I found it quite satisfying to drill the holes. Then I got the screws I intended to use. They had flat heads. How were they going to fit without splitting the wood? Somewhere in my memory the word countersink popped up. I took a look in a small block of wood that held the drill bits, each in a hole roughly sized to take it. There was one bit that wasn't like the one I was using to make a hole. It had a head about half an inch across with a business end that was a set of ridges leading to a point at 45 degrees. I swapped out my drill bit for this, but kept the drill bit handy for my next try. The special bit made a nice indent in the top of the holes. Taking a screwdriver, I found it easy to put in the screws. Then I took them out, I wanted to add glue. That was still under the stairs. Bother. Well, I'd have a cup of tea and come back. Better lock up, though. Tools were becoming like gold these days. Part 043. After my tea, it was about 3 o'clock. Not a lot of time before it got too dark to work. I'd better set up a hook for a lamp or two. Anyway, I'd get one, possibly both LS made. They were about 15 inches on a side. I wondered if I needed a cross brace. Probably not for our ladders, which were not that heavy. I put glue on the joint, then put in the screws. Drilling made everything so much easier. I recalled William trying to put in a screw and cursing as it kept falling over, and finally the screwdriver had slipped and stabbed his hand. I had to bandage him up, and he never did finish that job. I think we had, as people said, to get a man in to do it. Well, I was going to change that expression. The second L took me only about 10 minutes. I was going to put them up on the wall. Oh! Better drill them. I had some 3.5-inch round head screws. After measuring and positioning, and with the screws partly turned in so their tips were just showing, I tried the first. I hadn't drilled the wall post. As an experiment, I took the hammer and gave the top screw a good tap. The point of the screw made a mark where I could drill. I repositioned the L and tapped the bottom screw, then drilled its hole. Now I could attach the first L. The second L was on the wall by 4 o'clock. Now light was getting dim. I decided to pack things in for the day and get Oliver or Delia to help me put the ladders on these racks tomorrow. They'd also be in a good place to paint or varnish them. I wonder if there's any varnish anywhere. Someone's been busy. Mabel. Didn't hear you coming. I like how you've organized the tools. What have you been working on? These ladder racks. Here, give me a hand and we'll hang them on. We were easily able to put the arms of the LS through the ladders and both just fitted. If there's some varnish, I'd like to get them protected from the wet. I don't think we have any varnish, but there's a gallon tin of boiled linseed oil. We should telephone George to ask if that will work. Part 044. George said the linseed oil would work well, but that we should give the ladders a bit of sanding to get rid of splinters and rough spots that would catch the rag used to apply the oil. And we should make sure to spread out the rag on some stones in case of spontaneous combustion. George had mentioned that before. I had seen a few sheets of sandpaper, so we were pretty well ready to go. George said to wrap a suitably sized piece of the sandpaper, it could be folded and torn to size, around a block of wood that fitted my hand. The next day after field work, I sanded the ladders, and over the following few days applied a couple of coats of oil. The ladders looked much better, and were now stored safely too. We didn't have a broom in the byre, but I found an old besom, a witch's broom, lurking in the chicken coop. Delia didn't like it and it was just propped at the back of the henhouse, so I appropriated it for the byre. It didn't get all the sawdust and other dirt, but was good enough. I'd watch for a better broom. Part 045. I'd written to Jack the day after I got his first letter. Described my work in the byre. Had a long, long contemplation of how to sign it. Finally decided on affectionately. Not love or always. After I'd written my closing, I actually felt all right with my choice. It was truthful without offering anything that I couldn't give. Within the week I had a reply. November 16th, 1941. Dear Mary. Thank you for writing back so quickly. It was a joy to read your description of what you've been up to in the byre. I can almost feel your excitement at getting the tools to work for you to create what you want there. That feeling of accomplishment makes getting up each day worthwhile. While you have said the results were less than perfect, you did say they were functional and solid. That counts for a lot, and as time goes on, your skills will improve. For me, it's similar. Except I don't think I'd better tell you too much about what I've been doing, apart, of course, for the regular beat plodding. As a sergeant, I do less of the actual beat, but I'm involved with helping the others, particularly our special constables, who are generally older men who have volunteered to serve with us. Their knowledge, or rather lack of knowledge, of laws and regulations means that they are simultaneously reluctant and overeager to act. So part of my job is to get them up to speed. We've fortunately not had a lot of crime. The usual drunk and disorderless, plus one case where we tumbled upon a black market operation. It was an out-of-town crowd from the East End in London, and they'd somehow got a bunch of tins of salmon and peaches. We only caught them because a child fell off a bicycle in front of their van. One of my special constables made traffic wait while a local nurse comforted the child until the ambulance came. They didn't want to move the child in case of a neck injury. As the constable was walking over to one of our police phone boxes, the sun glinted on the top of a tin, so he mentioned this when asking for assistance. By the time the ambulance came, I was there with another constable and the driver didn't give a very believable reason why he was in Bath. When we asked him to open the back of the van, my special constable noticed the man reaching in his coat pocket and pulling out a pistol. Ralph the special constable saw the handle and he had his truncheon out. Normally we leave the truncheon on our belt. Like I said, overeager. However, I'm glad of it this time, because Ralph whacked him on the wrist. Actually broke a bone or two, and the automatic pistol tumbled on the ground. CID is now tracing things back. We got to guard the tins. Almost a pity that overeager Ralph submitted his report with a full count, or some might just have been spirited away by mice so they could show up in Christmas stockings. Not that I'd really do that, though with shortages of nice things, there's a huge temptation. Must dash to catch the post. Affectionately, Jack. It was a good letter. And I appreciated the warm sentiments as to how my skills would improve. William was forever putting me down. Now I realized that he was wrong. In fact, I could work with tools much better than he could. I was capable, and moreover, I felt capable. I realized, too, that being appreciated and not criticized all the time was good for me. I was still making mistakes. Who didn't? But I was getting jobs done and everyone could see that. Part 046. Jack's next letter didn't arrive until almost the end of the month. He'd had to go up to London as guard on the Black Marketer. They actually took the van, with the fellow handcuffed around his good arm in the back. Jack drove. I wonder where he'd learnt. He didn't actually say in his letter, but I got the feeling that he was part of an operation to raid the Black Marketer's den, possibly driving the van in. There was a report in the newspaper of a series of arrests. One of the men arrested was actually a minor peer. That would go down like a bunch of lead bricks in the House of Lords. The main point of Jack's letter, however, was to invite me to spend Christmas Day with him and his family. Apparently, he was getting Christmas leave, in part on account of good work. The suggestion was that I take the train up to Wells on Christmas Eve and return to Taunton on Boxing Day. I had a bit of a sense of panic. This meant meeting Jack's family, and that implied that we were, or at least could be, much more than casual friends. Somehow I didn't want to admit that. Deep down, of course, I knew Jack and I got along well, and unless I was being fooled in the same way William had fooled me, he was a very different kind of man. Another part of me really did want to acknowledge a connection. I'd got the letter in the Morning Post and shoved it in my back trouser pocket and was reading it under the shelter of a small, open hut in one of the far plots. We had a couple of these shelters. Four posts with a piece of corrugated iron on the top at an angle tilted back to let water run off. Then the back and sides were made up of some rough sticks pruned from trees or bushes about 9 inches apart to make a sort of fence wall through which rushes or willow twigs were woven. These walls didn't go all the way to the roof, but about 5 feet. Then we'd set up some sort of bench or stools to sit on. A place to get out of the rain and take a breather, with the woven twigs and rushes reducing the wind. I had a thermos of tea, and poured myself a steaming serving into the cap of the thermos, then sipped it slowly. Toby was with me, leaning against my leg. Somehow I'd got used to feeling him there over the last few months. I pondered my situation some more. In taking on my new identity, I'd not appropriated any money or other property from anyone. Not even from William either, even though I probably was owed something, since I handed over all my wages to him and often got back less than I could use for the housekeeping. Miserable sod. Distance had not diminished my rage at him. Somewhere I'd read that it wasn't fraud to use a different name as long as there was no theft or transfer of wealth or property. Was that really true? Certainly things could be sticky if Jack and I were to get married. Though even that would be Mary Smith, who to my knowledge had never been married, marrying Jack Morrison. My previous person was only involved through the lines that suspended a parachute mine. Still, for now I could go to Wells for Christmas without committing any crimes. It was the future that possibly could be a problem. Getting close, even living together wouldn't be a crime, though it probably wasn't good for Jack's career. Marrying could be considered bigamy if it were traced to my link to William. That evening, I'd write back to Jack and say I'd be happy to come, and ask what I should try to bring. As I made up my mind, I realized I'd need a suitcase. My trusty pillowcase was not going to give the right impression. I stepped out of the shelter and went back to gathering the late part of the cobnut crop. Some people called them cobs, others hazelnuts, and yet others filberts. Mabel said they were really different varieties of similar plant species. Up to now, I'd never given the different names any notice at all when I saw them at the greengrocer or read about them in articles or books. On the farm, we seemed to have a mix of different types, and we didn't bother to separate them. For the main part of the harvest, we paid school friends of Oliver and Delia a halfpenny a pound to gather them from where they had fallen. We lost a few into pockets, they were a little too hard for children to crack in their hands or teeth, and we discouraged those who would try to crack them with one stone against another, mainly because it tended to crush the nut and waste it rather than concern for loss by diversion. We got a reasonable crop of nuts. About 200 weight. Moreover, they were from bushes that formed boundaries of the farm or between plots. Difficult to estimate the acreage, but it wasn't much. We'd had similar difficulties with working out yield for blackberries. There'd been a reasonable crop of those, but a goodly portion went in the mouths of the pickers, though their pay was tiny, so we accepted the diversion as part of tradition. Part 047. There wasn't nearly as much work on the farm at this time of year, so I was able to go to town to look for the things I felt I needed. Not that there was a lot available. The one or two suitcases available were eye-wateringly expensive or else likely to fall apart immediately. On my second visit to one shop that carried bags, the lady behind the counter, she'd been at the WI once I think, said having trouble finding something? Yes. I need some sort of suitcase when I go for Christmas to my, boyfriend's family. There's precious little available. Either made of gold or already falling apart. Does it have to be a suitcase? When I arrived here in Taunton, I'd been bombed out, and the rest center had given me a pillowcase. I still use it, but it won't make a good impression. I think I've seen you at the WI. And most of the members can sew. If you're one of them, you might be able to make use of something I have in the scrap box. Let me get it. She went through a curtain and I heard a bit of noise of things being moved, then she came back. We picked up this rucksack a few years ago, meaning to fix it up ourselves. But then, you know how you put things off, and now Bob's been made a special constable and assigned up in Bristol. The rucksack needs a new strap put on. I've a broken belt we were going to use, it's here inside. You'll need a big needle and an awl. We may have those. In any case, I think I'll find a way to fix that strap. And it looks like some of the seams could use refreshing. Yes. I think someone used the sack for trying to carry bricks. They'll take a lot of load, but that's too much, and I doubt it was new at the time. How much do you want for it? A shilling and it's yours. We were going to try for 5 bob fixed, but it's time it was gone from here. I took the offer, but I also spent 13 and 6 on a small but pretty leather handbag. I didn't want to use my old one anymore, as it might be a tip-off to my past. That's the last of my pre-war handbags, the shop lady said. They don't want to use the leather for a long strap. And most women want a big handbag that they can use to carry some shopping in. I like to be able to have my hands free, and to be able to tuck my bag under my arm in a crowd, I said. Good idea. A friend was complaining how someone grabbed her bag the other day. Huge nuisance, and it had all her family's ration books and the week's housekeeping. Bugger who took it dumped it behind a wall and some kids found it, but minus the money, of course. And on top, she'd already done all the rounds to get new ration books. I thought about Jack trying to apprehend miscreants such as those who stole the handbag. Anyway, I had a rucksack, and that meant walking with my things was a bit easier, though in a crowded train it might be best to take it off my back. When I fixed the strap, My efforts were a bit amateur in appearance, but served well. I added a handle at the top from some rope. In addition, Mabel had been cutting up an old Macintosh raincoat and using the waterproof material for a rain hat. I asked if I could use some of the material to cover the bottom of the rucksack. I even curved it up an inch or so at the corners and sealed it with puncture cement. Now I could set the rucksack down on a wet or dirty floor and sit on it. It was about 16 inches high, with a drawstring top and a flap cover that made a pretty good seat as long as there weren't things inside that would get crushed and broken. It's what you had to do on trains these days. Not easy to get seating. On my shopping outing, I still needed stockings. I'd only got one pair since I left my old life. When I got to Taunton, I figured I'd mainly do with socks, though truthfully the socks I had weren't suitable to wear with a dress or skirt, and none of my shoes were fashionable. I preferred to wear slacks, but for Christmas it would look better to have a skirt, costume, or dress. I had no illusions I'd find silk or nylon stockings, but was successful in finding a quite smooth pair of Lisle stockings. Well, they'd keep me warmer than the better-looking silk or nylon ones. I was so pleased with my purchases of stockings and rucksack that I nearly forgot I'd need a suspender belt and had to go back to some of the shops. It shows how I was still somewhat disorganized that I'd not tried wearing the one pair of stockings I'd acquired earlier, and hadn't registered the need. Of course, I'd not worn a skirt or dress at all during that time, except maybe once with bare legs. Suspender belts were a stupid garment, though the vulgar postcards seemed to think men got excited at a glimpse of the suspender straps. I thought tights would be more sensible, but those seemed to be only worn by showgirls in theatres. Did I read or hear somewhere that tights weren't being made because of the extra material required? If there were elastic available, I could use garters, but they'd cut off circulation if they were too tight. Oh well, wear the suspenders when I had to, and carry some ribbon in case of necessity for garters. By preference, however, I'd still wear my slacks and socks. I was about to head home when I noticed that an optometrist's was open and went in. The man behind the counter asked, "May I help you?" "I'm finding I have to squint when I'm sewing and thought I might need glasses," I said. "A test will only take a few minutes. However, at the moment we can only offer utility pattern spectacles unless you have your own frames, and then only if the lenses are compatible with those frames." "I don't have any frames, and I work outdoors, so I'll live with the available frames when I need to sew or read." The test showed I was actually very slightly far-sighted, but not really enough to require spectacles. The optometrist offered a slightly higher strength prescription than he said I needed, since it would magnify for close work, but he warned it would possibly be uncomfortable for wearing all the time, and perhaps make it difficult to drive or ride a bicycle. I debated the possibilities, and decided on the higher magnification and put down a deposit. I would have to pick up my spectacles just before Christmas. Part 048. Peter came home on leave on the solstice. Sunday, December 21, 1941. The previous couple of weeks had, as expected, been quiet in terms of work on the farm. We did some odds and ends of repairs to hedges and fences, tightened hinges and clasps, checked locks. Some windows were drafty, and we got some putty from George and kneaded it well in the warmth of the kitchen. We'd need to clear out crumbled old putty with, what else, a putty knife, then push in fresh and run the putty knife blade along the new material to give it a smooth line. Mabel did the downstairs. She was all right on the small stepladder. I did the upstairs, given her fear of heights. Fortunately, the upper edges of the windows were fine. It was always the bottom and occasionally the side of the frames where the putty was cracked or broken. A matter of exposure to the rain. One day we also harvested a goodly volume of Brussels sprouts, popular for Christmas dinner. And we dug out some parsnips too. Still, not anywhere near the amount of product we were sending to the shops in the late summer. Outside of our tasks, there was lots of talk about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and a wave of optimism now that the Americans were on our side. Especially as Hitler, more fool him, declared war on the USA. On the negative side, we now had a points allocation of just 16 points a month, and just about everything was on points. If, of course, you could find anything. Peter's train was due midday, so we all went to church in the morning, then Matilda and I came back to prepare a hot midday lunch. Most people called it dinner. On the farm, we tended to eat our big meal in the evening. Tea. Strange how what you called your meals depended on class. Dine with me meant an big evening meal to the upper crust. Come for tea meant a generally lighter meal late afternoon to the hoi polloi, while dinner was usually in the middle of the day. I didn't really know how I, as common as you might get, still ate a big meal quite late, mainly to take advantage of daylight and to avoid interrupting work to walk back and forth to the crops. When the Gaffneys tumbled into the house together, Mabel's smile showed her joy that Peter was home again for a few days. She kept near him. The children showed a bit of reserve. Probably they weren't used to seeing their father in uniform. We were all hungry. Hell, we were always hungry. Thus there was a quiet time while we ate. I felt Toby against my leg, and looking to the side, could see Reggie's tail. He was lying against Peter. The dog hadn't forgotten him. I was very glad. Matilda asked, "Are you allowed to tell us anything about where you are or what you're doing?" "Well, I'm in one of the anti-aircraft divisions and we're, shall we say, somewhere in the southwest. I joined the Territorials, as you know, when things were getting hot with the Spanish Civil War, but my call-up was deferred because we're producing food, but eventually my training on, let's say certain guns meant they needed me. We have a go at Jerry planes if they get close to us. Wish we had more guns and more crews. There's talk of training up some ATS women as gun crew, but the brass are saying they won't let them pull the lanyard." Matilda said sourly as usual, "Let the women to the heavy job and say only men are capable of putting a finger on the button." "I don't disagree. All polished metal, fruit salad ribbons and posh accents." I could see why Mabel liked her husband. The contrast with William gave me one of my flashes of rage, but I kept it to myself, of course. Part 049. I took the earliest reasonable train to Wells that I could on Christmas Eve. In fact, I got up at 5 o'clock. Toby looked at me suspiciously. "Sorry, old boy, you'll have to make do with Matilda's company for a couple of days." Matilda, bless her, was up too and made me some porridge and I got away to the station. I'd have to walk because I didn't trust leaving the bike at the station, even locked up, and there were no buses until later. Anyway, I made it in time. For once, no delays, and I was in Wells well before 8 in the morning and had to wait for Jack, who was coming in from Bath. His train was delayed. Fortunately, I was able to get a cup of tea and a biscuit and find a seat out of the weather to wait. After I'd been given a big hug and a slightly more than polite kiss, Jack said we could try to find a taxi, or walk the 2 miles. "As you see, I'm set for walking," I answered.
"Indeed you are.
Hope you don't mind my wearing slacks. Since I've been working on the farm, I like to keep my legs warm, and trains in December are drafty. What do you do in summer?" "I found a couple of pairs of ripped pants secondhand and cut them down and sewed cuffs, so I've now 2 pairs of shorts. I also made myself a pair of very light slacks to protect against bushies and the sun. Matilda brought her sewing machine and has been teaching me how to use it."
"Useful. And I don't mind you wearing slacks. Mum might observe that girls didn't used to wear trousers, but I think she's been altering her view since seeing some of the jobs women have started to do lately."
"Yes. Peter was saying that there's talk of training ATS girls to operate AA guns."
"Really? That's one for the books."
"Apparently they won't be allowed to pull the lanyard, but do everything else. Attitudes may change. I expect we'll see more women in the police, and not just as women constables to take care of female prisoners. I know I'd rather have a strong young woman as my number one than some of the old codgers who've been made specials. Some of them have to take a break after the effort of lighting their woodbine. Have you been doing all right? That black market villain you caught had a gun. If it hadn't been for the special constable you said was overeager, he might have shot someone, and that could have been you.
True. Some of the villains are pretty nasty. It's going to be a lot of work to shut them down, or at least hinder their activity. It is, after all, hurting the war effort. I'd like to see Parliament add some offences to aiding the enemy, which would mean a possible firing squad in egregious cases. But even if they did, we may have to have them up for dodging national service or something else fairly minor, but enough to get them off the street. They had to do that in America with Al Capone. Got him for income tax evasion, even though they knew he'd been involved in everything from running prostitution to wholesale murder involving machine guns. Please look after yourself, Jack. For me and your parents, if not for yourself. Nice to have someone, someone pretty, to care about me. And I'd better tell you I care about you too. Might be awkward with family about. We were coming to a row of shops, and one of them had the Morrison name on it. There was a queue of women, it was always women, waiting to get vegetables, no doubt for the Christmas dinner. The shop front was fully open and there was a narrow passage between trolleys at the front of the shop. I saw potatoes, cabbage, carrots, parsnips, Swedes, turnips, Brussels sprouts. A few onions were in a small bin near the scale. Onions had been scarce since France and the Channel Islands fell. Though the sign said greengrocer and fruiterer, there were only a few apples for fruit that I could see. There was a woman weighing some potatoes. When she saw Jack, she smiled broadly and said, "Jack, there you are. Cedric. Jack's here. Mrs. Murphy, let me get you sorted so I can say hello to my son." A man came out from the back of the shop and gave Jack a handshake. Jack said, "Dad, this is my friend Mary the first told you about. Nice to meet you, Mary. You too, Mr. Morrison." Mrs. Morrison had finished with Mrs. Murphy. Cedric said, "Angela, you take Jack and Mary inside for a cup of tea and I'll handle the customers." "Not on your own, you won't, Dad. Mary can take my case and I'll give you a hand. I'll just hang up my coat and hat and put on a serving coat." Cedric and Angela had brown lab-style coats that most grocers wore. Within a couple of seconds, Jack had one on and was greeting a customer as Angela led me to the rear of the shop, where there was a storeroom. There was also a doorway with an open door and I saw a staircase behind. Up we went, and I found myself in a quite large living room. Towards the back was a table that was clearly the dining table, then a doorway to what turned out to be the kitchen. There was a stairway parallel to the one we'd ascended, and Angela led me up after telling me to leave Jack's case, as he'd be sleeping on the settee. "You'll be in Jack's room. He can put up with the settee. Now through there is the lavatory, and that door is the bath and sink. Audrey's through that door there and we're in the front. I'll let you get settled, then come down and we'll get to know each other." "Thank you," I said. "May I use the hangers in the wardrobe?" "Course you can. I cleared some space so you could." I unpacked, carefully taking out the biscuit tin in which a half dozen eggs were packed in straw. I'd also brought some biscuits and cake I'd made from carefully hoarded rations. I also had some small presents, a jar of WI strawberry jam for Cedric and Angela, and a Swiss Army knife not quite the same as mine that I'd found looking very dirty and slightly rusty on a market stall one day. I'd spent quite a bit of time cleaning it up and with some advice from George had learnt how to re-rivet the handle so the blades didn't wobble. I even attached a leather fob from a piece left over from fixing the rucksack and had managed to burn a J into it with a nail held on a stick with wire that I heated in the fire of the stove. I had hung up my sailing jacket, it served as my raincoat and was quite warm if I wore a pullover or two under it. That's what I'd done today, and I took off the top one of these, a button-up cardigan actually.
Then I realized I still had on my beret. That was a Christmas present from me to me. My old Trilby was still fine for workwear, but it did have its share of dust and stains, and I'd spotted the beret in a fundraising sale the WI held in early December. I hung up my skirt. My dress was too summery for Christmas. The skirt was still my only one, the one Maud handed me when I got to Taunton. With several bits of attention, it now looked all right, but I should start to look for a decent costume. I laid my spare blouse on the bed. Wear it tomorrow, then put on the one I was wearing to go home. Not worth risking smuts from the trains on both my blouses. I'd leave my spare knickers and socks in the rucksack, which I simply left on the floor by a plain chair. After I'd been to the lavatory and washed my hands, I went down to the kitchen where I found Angela had put out the tea and some mince pies. Sorry, there's just one each. You understand. Later we'll have some little things I've made from odds and ends of fruit I've managed to preserve. As a greengrocery, we get some banged up items and I'm getting far too clever at salvaging things.
Oh. Eggs. For us.
Didn't Jack tell you about the farm? Well, really a small holding, where I live and work. We have chickens and rabbits and produce all kinds of vegetables and fruit on about 15 acres. I think the Ministry of Food people are wondering if we should be amalgamated into a bigger operation, but we're on the outskirts of town and the land has ditches and gravel paths between our plots, so they'd need to do a lot of work. Besides, I think we're outproducing some of the farmers. Jack said it was just you and the lady who's the missus of the place, plus her children. And since Mabel's father passed away, her mother Matilda has come to live with us. She does a lot of the cooking and housekeeping, which frees Mabel to work on the crops. Do you get a chance to use some of your own produce, or must you send it all to market? Anything rationed is controlled more or less, but most of our products aren't on the schedule. That may be one of the reasons the ministry men want to poke their noses in. But then many people wouldn't get much in the way of variety in vegetables. I was going to bring some sprouts, but Jack said he was sure you had a reliable supplier. Yes. An older couple run an operation that sounds a lot like the one you work at. And they are keeping an eye out for the ministry men too, but their operation is on the side of a hill. Tractors topple over. They work it pretty well all by hand, though they have a donkey that they use to bring stuff into the shops, and I think they use it when they need to work some difficult soil. We use a neighbor with a donkey in much the same way. Our conversation rambled on in this fashion until 1 o'clock, when I heard Mr. Morrison shout, "Mrs. Howard, you're the last in the queue. I'll serve you, but nobody else. Wednesday early closing as usual." Angela said we always close early Christmas Eve, but it being Wednesday means we don't have to apologize. I'd better get dinner on. There'll be a while tidying up, since things have to be put away so they're saleable on Saturday. Next Monday'll be a bugger, excuse my language, with messed up deliveries and everyone desperate for stuff. My offer of help was initially turned down, then I was given some carrots to slice. We had a nice hot dinner at around 2 o'clock of a meat and vegetable pie with potatoes and carrots. There was an apple crumble and custard for dessert. Given the difficulties of wartime rations, Angela had worked a near miracle, and I said so, which garnered me an appreciative smile. After dinner we had a small glass of port, then settled back around a modest fire in the living room with the wireless and books. I'd found a copy of And of Green Gables at the farm. Having never read it, I'd picked it up and decided it would be a good choice to bring with me. I knew nothing about Prince Edward Island. Sometime soon I'd need to go to the library and find out more. Jack was reading Titustat Eliot's Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. Somehow I was surprised that he liked poetry, but also that in another way, the surprise was not astonishment. Nor was it unwelcome. He was just less predictable than I had assumed. Good. Angela was reading a Hercule Poirot story by Agatha Christie. Don't expect me to behave like Monsieur Poirot, Mum. Real detective works much, much different. Jack had recently been told he'd be transferring to plain clothes work on a full-time basis. Cedric had two newspapers, The Telegraph and The Daily Mirror. I like two different viewpoints so I can try to average them and hope for the truth. I could appreciate the sentiment, but wondered how many viewpoints were really needed. Two seemed far too limited. Something seemed missing.
Ah!
There was no tobacco smoke. Nobody in the house smoked. Well, I'd not yet met Audrey, who was in the ATS and should be here by 6 on a 48-hour leave. Still, it was unusual that nobody smoked. At the farm, none of us who were there now did, but Peter liked a pipe, and I remember there was a hint of pipe tobacco in the air of the farmhouse when I had arrived. William had smoked Churchman's No. 1 cigarettes. When we first married, it didn't bother me, but as time went on, the smell of them became a source of torment. Truthfully, I was very glad Jack didn't smoke. I should tell him in case he's thinking of taking it up.